At 5, 200 people were injured, 52 critically, following last night's terror attack in Nice. 84 people have died, Annie Green reports.
A man was shot dead by police after driving a lorry through a crowd of people watching fireworks for Bastille Day. Some British people are understood to be injured, including Lawrence.
There was debris and people lying, obviously seriously injured or maybe even dead.
French President François Hollande says everything must be done to fight this terrorist plague.
France is crying. She's hurting, but she is strong.
Theresa May says the UK and France will stand shoulder to shoulder.
We must redouble our efforts to defeat these brutal murderers.
3 days of national mourning have been declared.
It's believed the body of author Helen Bailey, who went missing in April, has been found at her Hertfordshire home. A 55-year-old man who's from Royston is being held on suspicion of murder. Theresa May has met with Scotland's First Minister in Edinburgh to discuss the UK's vote to leave the EU. Nicola Sturgeon says a second referendum on Scottish independence is now highly likely. She insists blocking one would be inconceivable.
We've heard from other Conservative politicians in the past few weeks that that would be the wrong thing to do as well. So, you know, I work on the basis that trying to block a referendum, if there's a clear sense that that's what people in Scotland want, would be completely the wrong thing to do.
Sir Philip Green has written to MPs defending his ownership of BHS. The billionaire tycoon insists he pushed for a sustainable solution to the firm's troubled pension scheme. In sport, Pakistan's convicted spot fixer Mohammed Amir has taken his first wicket since returning to Test cricket, dismissing England captain Alistair Cook at Lord's. A short time ago, England were 193 for six in their first innings. That's the latest.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Our guest is Jeff Gollop from the Conservative Party here in Bristol, and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we take a look at US goals in Europe for the last 100 years with George Friedman. He's the guy that really runs things, didn't you know? He's the founder and chief executive of something called Stratfor, which you've probably never heard of because the mainstream media here in London don't like to talk about them at all. Plus, good old Henry Kissinger, the Bilderberg spider. He's been shown to have been giving technology to the Russians, that is nuclear technology, way back in the 1970s. We hear from Anthony Sutton. Plus, last night's horrific attack in Nice, in France, we'll be pulling that apart as well. As well as the decision by the International Court of Justice in The Hague, earlier this week, about the South China Sea and the Spratly Islands, something we'll be hearing more about, no doubt. We'll be hearing all about that stuff in the second hour, but before all that, it's time for the fortnightly weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 Celsius, feeling muggy with some drizzle this weekend. Highs of 21, mainly cloudy weekend though, with bright spells and feeling muggy. Oh, sounds hot and humid. Gosh, next week, temperatures going up to 27 Celsius, sunny and warm at the beginning of the week, but cooling off with some thunderstorms as the week progresses. Next weekend, the 23rd and 24th of July, highs of 21 and some sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to discuss the week's news is Jeff Gollop. I think it's, am I right in saying West Beyond Trim and Henley's, Jeff? Have you had boundary changes in the last election at all?
We did indeed, yes.
So you're a bigger or smaller ward up there?
It's now a three-member ward rather than two separate two-member wards. So it's a larger population, less councillors.
You know what I always think? I think someone's fiddling the figures when they start moving these boundaries.
oh, we all think that. But in reality, it's a reflection that parts of Bristol, the population in growth has been quite substantial, and other parts it hasn't. And there was a need to redistribute the boundaries to make sure that there's fairer representation.
Let's kick off with discussing the incredible events. I mean, I can't find them incredible. I suppose I shouldn't really. On Monday, with the announcement that Andrea Leadsom wouldn't be standing. I mean, we have all this kind of competition going on. The way the Conservative Party leadership election works is that the MPs decide on two candidates, and then the membership in the Conservative Party, that's about 150,000 people around the country, have paid their dues, whatever it is, I suppose £20-50 a year to join, and they hope, don't they, Jeff, to get some sort of say in who the leader's going to be. But they were denied that opportunity. It looked to me as if this was a kind of bullying operation, really, by the Murdoch press, really to convince Andrea Leadsom that it wasn't worth standing. And so on Monday she announced that she wouldn't, and she was withdrawing. So the membership as a whole don't get any say in who takes over.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. I think the membership as a whole didn't get any say in how the process would work and develop. I may not be representative, but my feeling was that both for the party and the country, we needed a leader in place very quickly. So I have to say, I feel this is by far the best outcome, because with so much going on in the UK and around the world, we needed a Prime Minister in place who actually was there to govern, not one who was holding on till the appointment of their successor.
Well, I mean, there was nothing at all wrong with just letting David Cameron carry on for a month and a half, 6 weeks or so, until there was a leader who had been chosen by democratically, shall we say.
I think the question of what is democratic, the democratic decision was taken a year ago when the government was elected. We have a different Prime Minister, but at the end of the day, we have the same party.
But hang on, because what about the party membership? Don't they deserve some kind of say in who takes over from David Cameron? What's the point in paying dues to the Conservative Party if you don't get any say?
There's a really interesting balance here, and the Labour Party's got this going in the opposite direction of the question of, you can't lead the party easily if you do not have the support of both the membership and the membership of the parliamentary party. Conservative Party members in general are extremely supportive of their party leader, and I have a feeling that the majority of those 150,000 will be extremely happy with Theresa May being the new Prime Minister.
And what about this role of Rupert Murdoch? I mean, there's some commentators saying, oh, Rupert Murdoch has chosen our Prime Minister this time because of the bullying of Andrea Leadsom. I mean, she made some offhand comment about she had children, whereas Theresa May didn't, and that might make a difference. And this was turned into massive headlines, even though it was supposed to have been a comment off the record. Suddenly, this was there was a big hoo-ha about what she'd said.
I'm really intrigued to hear you defending Andrea Leadsom against Mr. Murdoch. I think any politician knows that when they're talking to a journalist, that there is, even when they're off the record, that there is the possibility that what they say will be quoted. And I think there's a need to try and be careful. I would try to put my words in a way when I'm talking to you that can't be misrepresented, but I got no guarantee that by the end of this evening I won't have failed abysmally in that.
So, well, I suppose radio is a bit easier in that way.
I think you have to be extremely careful, and actually, you know, in that case, if you heard the interview that she gave, actually the journalist reported what was there. So I saw that someone, I have no time for Mr. Murdoch at all, but it was a politician playing into the press hands by giving a comment like that, unasked for and unsolicited and unforced, that caused those headlines. So I think it possibly is the question of, should someone who makes comments like that unforced be in a position to be our Prime Minister? And I think she concluded she wasn't quite ready for that role yet.
So it's just coincidence that the establishment, the City of London's choice, Theresa May, became Prime Minister without a fight, really?
I'm not sure that Theresa May would be considered as part of the establishment in the way that David Cameron was. And therefore, I think that that in itself is an interesting outcome.
Well, one of the things she has been doing is she has been implementing some pretty savage cuts at the Home Office. 20,000 police around the country have gone since she took over. Also chaos in our prisons with wildcat strikes by prison officers who are, even though they're not allowed to go on strike, are sometimes just turning up for work and refusing to do anything because their job is not safe anymore because of all the cuts there. But I suppose most importantly, from many of our point of view, is her kind of big brother approach with the pushing through this thing called the Snoopers Charter, which is basically bringing into law what GCHQ have been doing illegally for years, which is using the internet and telephone networks and bugs, etc., to spy on people. We're talking about journalists, we're talking about lawyers, we're talking about MPs even, and people like yourself. That's the kind of thing that she wants brought into a more acceptable legal framework, where there's no need to go for the security services to go to get a warrant to spy on people. Now, this really does sound like an Orwellian world she's been ushering in, and that's why I point to her as the establishment candidate.
I think there is an impossible balance to be had here between the controls and checks and balances that we need to maintain a safe society. You referred to the outrage in Nice. How do we protect against that and maintain civil liberties?
And you know what I'm going to say now? How on earth would spying on MPs, lawyers and journalists stop someone driving a truck into a crowd?
I understand that. And I say it's a very, very hard balance to get that bit right. I have the view that if you're doing nothing wrong, you don't have a problem in being spied upon because you've got nothing to hide. And I think it's a very, very difficult balance.
Well, I can tell you why I do, because that information that's gained about me could be used for all sorts of purposes. It can be even sold to what you might say are people that might have an interest in that information. Marketing information is one that almost everybody is experiencing one way or another, getting either junk mail or internet spam of one sort or another that they didn't want because they've been put under surveillance, even by somebody like Google, who are essentially kind of front end for the
NSA. Google, I'd have a different issue with, and I think that is much more intrusive and actually much more frightening.
Martin, what do you make of this whole Snoopers Charter? Because that's really the main thing that many people know Theresa May for, other than the police cuts and the prison service cuts. I mean, she wasn't directly prison minister, but the Snoopers Charter is something pretty Orwellian, and it really is. It's almost like this is a genuine attempt to destroy civil liberties. There's the other aspect, of course, that Theresa May, although she's now apparently backtracked on it, she was campaigning to get us out of the European Court of Human Rights.
Well, in the US Constitution, written in 1776, they put a clause in it.
This is Britain, by the way. Yeah.
No, but I'm just pointing out there was a clause in that said that no private communication should be interfered with by the government without a warrant from a magistrate. In other words, without reasonable suspicion. And of course, in those days, they were talking about personal communications like letters, effectively, because, you know, in their struggle against the British, the Americans had written letters to each other, which the British had intercepted and so on and so forth. The technology we now have allows very intrusive surveillance, and of course, as you pointed out, Tony, the intelligence services have been using intrusive surveillance for years anyway, without any kind of legal basis. In other words, they've been doing it illegally, which could be argued is, you know, if you break the law, like stealing a bottle of water during a riot, there ought to be some punishment for those who've broken the law. But of course, what they're trying to do is bring the law in line with actual practice. Now, how good this, your point about how good this is at actually getting to the bottom of terrorism is another matter. Because of course, the facts going back decades is that NATO intelligence services have been intimately involved in the creation, particularly of jihadi terrorism from the 1980s onward in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda, as Robin Cook, the former Foreign Secretary, pointed out, was originally a database created in the capital.
Can we get back to the Snoopers Charter?
No, but this is what I'm trying to put the point I'm making. I wouldn't mind the police having intrusive investigative powers if they're genuinely independent of the government. But if they are actually being run by the intelligence services, who are actually implicated in the creation of terrorist organisations like Al-Qaeda, then I do have a problem with it. And I think ultimately we've got to get back to a law-based state where only the police have the powers of interception and only on the basis of reasonable suspicion. And the intelligence services are not empowered to carry out fishing expeditions, not because they might abuse that power, but because they are themselves potentially suspects in terrorism cases. And if people think that's far-fetched, they need to look at the history of NATO intelligence services, including the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980, which the Italian police are absolutely sure was carried out.
No, but Britain
is part of NATO.
You're taking us a long way away.
No, but Britain is part of NATO.
From the Snooper's Charter.
Well, no, I'm not taking you far from the Snooper's Charter, because the intelligence services are out of control. They created Al-Qaeda in the 1980s and then claimed that they lost control of it. I don't believe they ever did. And I think at some point the police are going to have to investigate these matters.
Anyway, what do you make of the idea that, I mean, it's not very democratic, is it, to have the intelligence services? I mean, this is basically what Watergate was about, Jeff, if the intelligence services are able to spy on the political opposition.
The political opposition have got the same democratic rights as the rest of us, and certainly there should not be spying on anyone who is part of a genuine democratic process. If someone is part of wishing harm to the economic well-being or the defence of the country, then they put themselves in a position where they potentially are vulnerable. The difficulty is who decides how far to push that line. And in this very complex technological day and age, I think that is a lot harder than it was in 1776.
Okay, let's just move on to have a listen now to the because we had a similar situation. I'm going to put this on to Martin now, because Gordon Brown had a very similar kind of thing, didn't he, when he was took over from Tony Blair. And back in 2010, the programme that used to follow this one, that is the typical topical Afro-tropical show with Patrick Cyrus, made a comment on that. So let's have a listen to what he had to say on this station back then about Gordon Brown taking over as Prime Minister without a proper election.
Yes, good afternoon. It's me, Sir Stavars, on the typical tropical Afro-tropical show. Have you heard? He's the Labour Prime Minister that was never voted in by the country. Shafted, grafted and laughing at us. Politics, politrics.
So that was Patrick Cyrus talking back in 2010, Martin. Politics, politrics. Mm. The idea that someone can be just sort of fated, really, by the establishment to take over.
Well, I mean, democracy is a concept, and it's also a practice. And the practice of democracy is not nearly as transparent as the theory. And we all know that in actual fact, who runs the country is not necessarily decided by who sits in number 10. There are other very powerful forces which actually constrain what anybody in number 10 can and can't do. And the sort of, you know, the creation of new prime ministers without general elections, I mean, surely that is the basis of the five-year Parliament Act, which Parliament has passed. So that, in fact, unless there is a complete breakdown in the confidence of the House of Commons, then the ruling party can nominate whoever they want to be the Prime Minister. Those are the rules as they stand. And they may feel it's in their interest to go to the country. For example, if there's some very nasty decisions that have to be taken. For example, coming back to the exact politics of Theresa May, she has got to decide whether she's going to go for full Brexit, which means leaving this European single market. No doubt she was discussing this with Nicola Sturgeon, or going for the Norway-Switzerland option, which means that you pay into the EU budget, you don't get anything out of it, and you have to accept free movement of labour to retain access to the single market. And it wasn't made clear to the voters when they were voting on this whether they were voting for full Brexit or Brexit light. Brexit light, in fact, is essentially not leaving the European Union. You carry on paying into the budget, but you don't get anything out of it. Full exit means that a big swathe of businesses in this country will face tariff walls against their exports into the European Union and will have to reorientate their sales pitches to Bangladesh and China.
What do you make of the whole Brexit thing, Jeff? Because one of the things that people always seem to forget when they're talking about this is actually exports are minimal compared to what they used to be from Britain. Almost everything is import. So there's, I mean... It is true. Our balance of trade is in a diabolical state.
That's true.
We import far, far more than we export. So actually, could there maybe, if there are more trade barriers come up after 2 years after the Article 50, if all this happens, because some people are saying that they're going to have another referendum because we didn't get it right, apparently. So anyway, what do you make of the Brexit vote a few weeks ago?
Well, a whole host of issues come out of that. I mean, certainly if you talk about the trade deficit, if one went back 30 years, governments would have been panicking at the trade deficit and would have been applying all manner of processes to influence interest rates and currency to regulate the deficit. The current economic thinking is that the balance of payments deficit doesn't matter. That's a concept I find it hard to come to terms with, and I think that ultimately one has got to redress that balance. The weakness in sterling will help to redress that balance, but at the end of the day, the difficulty I see is that we need access to the free market, because what we do export is still very important to us and creates jobs for us here. We need the ability to trade with that market, and we don't readily have other markets that are going to be capable of replacing it. And it would seem that the EU is likely to suggest that we need to allow free movement of labour in order to achieve being part of or having access to the free market. So actually there are an awful lot of conundrums still to resolve in getting this sorted. I would have thought that 2 years is going to be a very short period of time in terms of reaching that resolution. But at the end of the day, that's the decision the referendum has taken, and we can debate about what questions should have been asked, but we've got a decision on the basis of the questions that were asked. So I guess we've got no option but to make that happen. The Norwegian example, though, is not only Norway paying in, but actually having no say over the decisions that are taken, either at commissioner level or at European Parliament level. So you've actually got, in my view, the worst of all worlds.
Interesting. Martin, I suppose you would agree, but I mean, isn't there actually likely to be more jobs in Britain if there's less stuff being imported? Maybe more things that we buy here, manufactured goods, are going to actually be made in Britain in the future.
Well, it reminds me of the interview I had when I went to up to Oxford in 1976, and the interviewing panel said to me, "What do you understand by the term siege economy?" Because at that stage, until 1979, nobody could leave Britain with more than £1,000 without government permission. The economy was still heavily regulated, and it was possible to imagine the government deciding that it was going to sort of batten down the hatches and, you know, basically stop imports from coming in by creating tariff walls, planning industry inside Britain and so on. It seems like a completely different era because it was. And I think it's very difficult to imagine in the modern era that you could survive and carry out such a policy, barring big accidents in the financial services sector, which I'm afraid are quite likely. It may be that, you know, current things like exchange controls will come back into fashion at some point because they're not irrational when you're in a desperate situation. But I don't think any of these things have been thought through. And I think the problem politically within the Conservative Party is that those who are very keen on Brexit, and Michael Gove was very clear about this, they want to leave the European Union completely and the single market
as
well.
Martin, you're making out, and this is just simply not true, that the EU is in some sort of reasonable economic state.
I'm not suggesting that for a minute.
This is the China Daily this week saying a new debt crisis beckons for the unstable German banks in the EU's next meltdown. Yeah. Europe is seriously ill, according to Deutsche Bank, and while Italy's problems have been well documented recently, analysts said that a closer look at German banks reveals even Europe's economic powerhouse could find itself in financial difficulties. While Brexit seems to have served as a catalyst for Europe's political crisis, financial experts are warning a crisis also appears to be brewing on the European financial front. So, you know, surely it's better that we have some sort of insulation from
that.
Well,
the fact of the matter is, if the euro collapses, and it's quite likely to do so, and Deutsche Bank collapses, and I think that's quite likely to happen, what effect do you think that's going to have on the City of London within about 10 seconds? Never mind 10 10 years, the idea that people can sit on this side of the channel and watch a collapse of the Eurozone and say, Godwin, it's nothing to do with us, is idiotic. Our biggest trading partner is, in fact, the Republic of Ireland, and they have got, they're estimated to lose massive chunks of their GDP as a result of our decision. They're not likely to be very happy about that, and of course the fact that Brexit is pushing the pigs, the Portugal, Ireland, Greece, Italy, Spain, their bond markets are collapsing as a result of Brexit. That's not likely to make them very well disposed to us going forward. And the idea that there's some kind of collapse in the Eurozone means that we're better off sailing into mid-Atlantic and watching from afar is absurd, because we're going to go down that hole with them.
Jeff, let's just get on to have a look at the problems with the within the Labour Party. I think maybe we'll do some of the let's do some of the characters that have appeared in this new Theresa May cabinet this week first. Before that, I was looking at Boris Johnson as Foreign Secretary, expecting to see lots and lots of embarrassing comments and kind of ignorant comments, shall we say, about what was going on in other parts of the world, jingoistic stuff. Looking at what he was saying about Russia and about Ukraine, he was blaming the European Union for that whole situation erupting in Ukraine, saying that the European Union had been too voracious in trying to take on the financial management of Kiev and take it away from the Russians, and that was what had caused it. And down in Syria, he was giving a pat on the back for Assad for giving ISIS a hammering, effectively. So, you know, on some of the major policy issues, he does seem to be talking some sense. But what do you make of the choice?
I think it's a very brave choice. But I have to say, Boris Johnson has, in my view, the intellect to deal with it. He is quite a remarkable character and is certainly is very knowledgeable, both in terms of the languages he speaks and in terms of his knowledge of history. And I think that there's often we often miss the benefits of understanding what's happened in history is helping to determine where we go and what we do. So I think, providing he can tame the rather cavalier image that he's enjoyed creating over the last 4 or 5 years, or last 10 years, that actually he could be an extremely powerful foreign secretary. He will not be missed on the world stage. He will be noticed. And actually, in terms of the negotiations that need to happen in the years ahead, he will be a very good advocate for the UK. So I think it could be a very positive move.
Well, I also, looking at him, it seems to me that as a foreign secretary, he's perfectly placed that when Theresa May starts sinking in the mud, that he can then take over.
That could well be. I mean, certainly if anyone, you know, has a mandate out of the Brexit vote, it has to be Boris Johnson, who was very much the loudest voice in that.
Well, he doesn't have
team.
A mandate from Londoners, does he?
He doesn't have a mandate from Bristolians either on that basis, but the fact is that, and that's perhaps the saddest thing out of the referendum vote, that it's created divisions of communities across the country and between different parts
but
of the country.
Because those divisions were there. It's finally admitted that those divisions are there. I don't think it's possible really to say Brexit vote has created division. What it's done is it's brought something into the forefront that politicians have been trying to kick out of the way for decades.
You can argue that case in part. There are clearly divisions there which perhaps people have been trying to ignore, but what it has done is polarise views and created differences of opinion in areas where they were not being crystallised before, and that is not necessarily in the best interests of helping communities to work together and live together.
Well, I think at least it's meant that people are a little bit wiser as to how the European Union works, because there's this kind of thing in the background. This is the way I've seen it for years now, is it's something that's there that's sort of done to us, which we're not even supposed to ask questions about how does it work, even though it's apparently much more powerful than Westminster. Westminster is an old-fashioned system, but it does seem to be a little bit easier to understand. And once you get to the situation where the MPs we elect at Brussels can't actually make law, that they all they could do is kind of slow it down, then you start to realise that this isn't a proper kind of democratic organisation. It's not a proper lawmaking body. But Martin, what about Boris? What do you make of the choice for him as Foreign Secretary?
Well, as I say, as Jeff says, it's a brave choice, potentially controversial. He might come good because he's actually brainy, but he's very mercurial. You're never quite sure where he stands.
Well, he's into this thing called soft power, isn't he? Which basically, doesn't that just mean lying?
Well, no. We could go into what is and what is not soft power.
Well, what do you think soft power is?
Soft power is a stock phrase used in sort of policy wonk circles to refer to the alternative to bombing people is persuading them, basically. So soft power is just a...
Lying and propaganda.
No, it's just a meaningless phrase. It means, you know, if people eat McDonald's but hate the Americans, that's the soft power of Americans, that they still eat McDonald's. But, I mean, soft power, in my mind, is not really very useful term. It doesn't really...
Well, Boris likes it, uses it.
Well, he may like it, but it's not really very useful in describing his situation. What the government is going to find, is it's very easy to form a government, and it's very difficult to deal with the consequences of the situation we're in. And I'm not just talking about Brexit. That certainly does create problems and obstacles, as we've discussed. The real problem is that the economic policy of the government is now in ruins. There is no long-term economic plan. There never was. We are not going to reduce the deficit by 2020. We never were going to.
What do you make of the departure? Okay, you've decided to take us on to talk about the economy again. But George Osborne's departure, another Bullingdon Club member.
Well, I think George Osborne's departure is interesting because, I mean, that means, I think from Theresa May's point of view, if she gets rid of George Osborne, she can change her economic policy. And then pretend that she hasn't changed. It just says, well, it's Philip Hammond's policy now, that's what we're doing. But I think what people should focus on like a laser is that all of this talk of reducing the deficit to an agreed timetable and even putting it into law, that is history. Also, of course, interestingly enough, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership may also be history. Peter Lilly, on the right of the Tory party, is opposed to the TTIP, but I believe Michael Gove and others are in favour of it, which I find really bizarre. So we're leaving the European Union to get economic sovereignty back, but we're going to sign up to a trade deal with the Americans, which is going to be signed by the EU, which will determine everything to do with how your market works. But that's okay, because that's free trade. None of it's free trade. It's all rigged. The question is who rigs it and whose interests.
Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing about the economy, on previous occasions, Martin and I have differed on the views about austerity, and I believe there was a need for an austerity chancellor and an austerity budget. When the economy was at its weakest and most vulnerable. However, there becomes a point at which the continued austerity budget could have been counterproductive, and there was a recognition that actually we have to look at how we sustain the economy to generate the revenue that's needed to maintain the services and the benefits that we pay.
Well, let me just say one thing. Collect the tax from the big corporations who are avoiding it all around the world.
Absolutely. Don't disagree with you for a moment on that.
Can I just mention on that, of course, that one of the things that got slipped through by the City of London in the post-Brexit era is, in order to stabilise the economy, one of Osborne's last acts was to cut corporation tax. Because we've got to do that. And it seems, and also the City of London pushed David Cameron to negotiate all sorts of exemptions for them from other European countries, which was hardly talked about in the referendum campaign at all.
What do you make of that, cutting corporation tax? Is that counterproductive? Good idea, Jeff?
I don't have a problem with reducing corporation tax if that leaves more funds available for businesses to invest in jobs and capital equipment. And we have to create a situation where businesses have the ability to do that. But your point earlier, absolutely right, that has to be fair for all. It doesn't have to be. There's no point in reducing by the odd percentage the amount of tax that small businesses pay if multinational businesses aren't paying any tax in the first place. And that balance has to be redressed. There's been pressure on chancellors from going back to when Gordon Brown was in the Treasury, and on all occasions the chancellors have failed to deliver the level of control that's needed to get that tax revenue in.
Another I would say probably the most controversial choice is Liam Fox getting this this new government ministry set up in his honour, which is international trade. And the problem here is that Liam was forced out of government back in 2011 for what seems to me to be very good reasons. Martin, the former ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, did a lot of investigation into what had been going on with Liam Fox and this guy called Adam Werity, who ran a charity called Atlantic Bridge. And one of the things he discovered was that these two together were trying to promote the idea of having a war with Iran. And it looked as if this Adam Werity guy could be connected to Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service.
Yeah, and I think that's the... And, of course, he was getting access to security, secure meetings.
He was when bringing this guy into the Ministry
when he wasn't,
of Defence.
When he wasn't, yeah. actually, he wasn't actually vetted by British intelligence. But I think it's interesting that the charity, they said it was called Atlantic Bridge, because Liam Fox is a very great friend of the neoconservatives in the United States of America. And it's interesting that they've set up this new department, the first I've heard of it, the International Trade Department, because I'm quite sure that his task will be to push through the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
That's what that will be about. Of course, Liam Fox was very much in favour of leaving the European Union, so I don't know how he squares this. So we're going to sign the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is a stitch-up between the EU and the Americans, in which we'll have no say, and we're going to sign up for that even though we're outside the EU. So the EU will tell us what to do, and the Americans will tell the EU what to do. That's why we voted for Brexit.
Okay, uh-huh. 2 days in, we've rumbled you, Liam. Anyway, what do you reckon, Jeff, as to this Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership? If Martin's right, and that's been part of his job, is to try and steer that through. Because a lot of people are pointing at it and saying, well, it's going to allow big corporations to sue governments who don't allow them access into things like the National Health Service, effectively to sort of bid for big contracts and slowly take over. I mean, that's just one example, the NHS, but it does... put the big companies, the big corporations we were talking about, the tax-avoiding corporations, in the driving seat against national governments.
I think there is a... I mean, if we're talking about the new appointments, and we just talk in that context, I think that we have got a team of three in terms of the Foreign Office. We've got the leader in the Brexit debate, the Brexit process, David Davis, and we've got Liam Fox developing international trade. Now, I am not so sceptical as Martin in this scenario. I see it as a recognition that if we are not part of the EU free market and a voting member of the EU, that we have to develop the trade links that are necessary with other countries. And therefore, I see that very much as the role. I don't think the TTIP issue is the key issue in this process. I think Martin's absolutely right about it being somewhat ironic that we choose to get out of one while we're effectively potentially signing up to the other. But I don't think that is what that appointment is about. That appointment is about opening up markets for us to trade with. And go back to our discussions about our balance of payments deficit. We have not done well in either manufacturing or exporting. So if this is part of a government agenda to put exporting on the map and developing those trade links, then I'd say it's something we need to welcome.
OK, well, let's have a little look at the Labour Party fiasco, which has been the very narrow vote that decided that Jeremy Corbyn was going to be allowed to stand to be the leader of the Labour Party. One of the fascinating things to come out of all that was that we've now just heard within the last day or so that a major party donor is mounting a legal action against the Jeremy Corbyn ruling. This legal challenge, says Tom Watson, is very unhelpful and destabilising the Labour Party. It's been made by Michael Foster, who once stood as Labour parliamentary candidate for Camborne, Redruth and Hale in Cornwall. He said, "It's about the rule of law. One of Labour's biggest donors has announced he will legally challenge the party's decision to allow Jeremy Corbyn onto the leadership ballot, Martin."
Well, what can I say? The decision has been made. If he wants to make a legal challenge, he can make it. But I can assure you party members will be furious that somebody who thinks that because they're a donor, they can own the party, this is precisely what many activists think is wrong with where the way the Labour Party has been run in the last 20 years, is that people like this have got a sense of entitlement to determine what's going to happen. And
who
I think,
is this Mr. Foster?
Because well, I've never heard of him.
I've been looking him up. This is Michael Foster. Apparently he caused a controversy in September last year for heckling Jeremy Corbyn after the party leader had failed to say Israel at a Labour Friends of Israel meeting in Brighton. Mr. Foster could be heard repeatedly shouting, "Say the word Israel! Say the word Israel!"
Well, yes, I mean, the right wing of the Labour Party are pretty pro-Israeli. And they wanted to make a fight out of this, and it will be a major issue in the election.
What has this got to do with whether Jeremy Corbyn is allowed to stand on the ballot or not?
Because what we're seeing is in a PR system like in Ireland or Denmark or any other civilised European country, all these different political forces will be out in the open. In our political system, which is actually just, you know, basically medieval with the first past the post set up, all of these forces have to operate behind the scenes in this kind of Shakespearean stab in the back fashion, and so everybody has to, you know, everybody has to fight behind the scenes to get what they want. I mean, what was fascinating to me about the NEC vote earlier in the week, which when they went in to conclave at 2 p.m. and they didn't come out till 9 p.m. and there was the right of the Labour Party were pushing for a secret ballot, which is extraordinary if you think about it. I mean, people need to know which way people voted in order to make decisions about whether they support them in future elections. But anyway, a secret ballot it was. They had a secret ballot, and what seems to have happened is that some people have promised the right, the Angela Eagle faction, that they would vote for them, and then they used the secret ballot to secretly vote for Corbyn. Just raised a chuckle on my side, I have to say.
Well, the Bristol MP, Kerry McCarthy, Labour MP, who's part of this, there are three, aren't there? Karen Smith, Thangam Debonair, and Kerry McCarthy, contacted all their offices again, as I've done the last couple of weeks, beginning of the week, asking them if they would like to appear and explain why they think it's a good idea to remove Jeremy and what their thoughts are about all that, but still no. I mean, basically, all three MPs have said no, they can't come on. I'll be keeping going, and eventually, hopefully, one of them will surface and we can ask them a few questions. But on Twitter, it's slightly a different thing because I posted something on Twitter earlier last week on my Twitter account at Tony Gosling, pointing out that Labour had won a town council by-election over in Wales with a 12% majority over the first over the Conservatives, and it's the first time Labour have ever won it. And Kerry McCarthy picked up on that tweet and replied, "Jeremy Corbyn's principled stance on dog poo and lampposts sweeping us to victory on town councils across the land, Martin."
Yeah, well, I think she's made her position pretty clear that she wants him out. Karen Smith probably always wanted him out. I think Thangam was a swing voter in this one, but she clearly wants him out. Interestingly enough, Marvin Rees has not taken sides, nor has Sadiq Khan.
That's
in
right,
London.
Yeah.
I think where we are in the Labour Party now is there's going to be an election within the Labour Party with whoever is empowered to vote. I think that the...
What about the taking away of the vote at the Labour National Executive on Tuesday from the recent people who recently joined the Labour Party?
Well, I signed a petition last night to say that anybody who's joined the Labour Party and identifies with the Labour Party should be allowed to participate within reason. You know, you can't have, you know, Conservative MPs joining the Labour Party to vote for who they want. That wouldn't be acceptable. But on the other hand, I think Jeremy Corbyn has touched a nerve. He has reached, there's a certain section of society that certainly regards him as a principled leader. And I think that as Lord Stoddart of Swindon on this show last week pointed out, they've missed the Labour Party, parliamentary party, have very much misjudged the mood of their own activists.
He was quoting Harold Wilson, wasn't he, saying a week is a long time in politics, and it certainly has been. But what about my point about Kerry, someone being elected for the first time into a first ever Labour win in this seat in Aberystwyth, and she's saying it's got nothing to do with Jeremy Corbyn?
Well,
because her point is, and principled stand, and as is Karen and Thangam's, is that Jeremy Corbyn's a loser.
Well, in actual fact, if you look at the local elections, in which, you know, we took control of Bristol and Marvin was elected as the mayor, the share of the vote by the Labour Party was a percentage point higher than that of the Conservative Party.
Well, I'm sure Kerry would say that this is because of local campaigners, not because of Jeremy.
Well, those local campaigners are people like me who don't agree with Kerry, Fangham and Karen. There could be a split in the Labour Party as a result of all of this. There was a split in the Labour Party in New Zealand in the early 1980s. I think these MPs ought to look into that, because they will see that it led to PR in New Zealand and a catastrophic defeat for the right wing of the Labour Party. The left wing of the Labour Party did rather well. They need to look into that and have a think about it. I don't suppose they have.
The Communication Workers has announced this week that it's withdrawing financial support for Bristol's three Labour MPs, saying Bristol West MP Thangam Debonair is not welcome back at the campaign base.
That's right, she was based in their headquarters.
Yeah, on Church Road, just across the road from here at the City Academy. The union said they've issued a vote of no confidence following the Labour MP's support for an attempted coup against the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn. Representatives from the Communication Workers Union office on Church Road voted on proposals to censure the Bristol MPs and back Jeremy Corbyn this week. They say all three MPs' seeming lack of support for the leader is a slap in the face. Is this delightful for you to witness this sort of stuff going on in the Labour Party, Jeff?
No, not at all. And I wouldn't want to comment specifically on local issues. But now more than ever, the country needs a strong opposition. And I have no doubt that a strong opposition strengthens the government and is more effective for the country. I think, however, and I'd look at some of the things that have happened in Bristol over the years, and there have been situations where proposals to change something could have been ruled out of order for all manner of reasons. And actually, we ended up taking the view that it was important that the vote took place so that members of council could express their opinion. If you rule the vote out of order and they can't express their opinion, you're disenfranchising the membership. And one cannot run away from the views of the membership.
Not Martin, and
that's true of both political parties. The parliamentary party can't be ignorant of and ignoring the views of the people who actually do the work to get them elected.
But isn't that what happened with Theresa May being just crowned queen rather than there being an election?
But it's very different, because I think the majority of Conservative Party members would entirely support Theresa May.
I would suggest to you that actually majority of Conservative Party members were probably more Brexiteers than Theresa May, who was a Remainer, and also that they would rather like to see a complete fresh face in politics rather than the old guard.
Well, the people I've talked to certainly very happy with the outcome and did not believe it. It was the Brexiters who were not member of the Conservative Party who wanted to see a Brexit supporter as the Prime Minister. Within the party, there was a definite feeling of wanting the voice of experience. It was someone who was able to deliver what the country needs.
Would have been interesting to have that vote, though. But Martin, going back to Thangam, these MPs, the Communication Workers say, did not bother to meet with their local parties or supporting trade unions before getting involved in this coup, which now has failed.
Well, they didn't consult. That's clear. And also, of course, I correct me if I'm wrong, but Kerry seemed to suggest that we didn't need to have an election, that Corbyn should just resign. The parliamentary party should choose someone acceptable to them, and that the parliamentary and that the membership as a whole should just swallow that. Now, that is a coup by any definition. It's overturning the constitution of the party. Now, I don't see how the parliamentary Labour Party can be a force of itself without the activists. And don't forget, in the kind of way politics we run in this country, with first past the post and all the rest of it, but also funded. In Norway, political parties are funded by the state. In Germany, they're funded by the state. In Britain, the Labour Party is funded by the trade unions. And the CWU are perfectly within their rights to say, you didn't consult us about this, we're not taking it lying down, and we're withdrawing our financial support from you. We're not in a position to deselect you at this stage. But of course, if this fight gets dirtier, then deselection will start to become part of what goes on. I think a split in the Labour Party, I'm not frightened of it. It happened in New Zealand in the 1980s. And what happened is that the trade unions and the left wing of the Labour Party and the activists seized control. won a democratic election within the party, then
so how long until this is, Martin, how long until this is all over and Jeremy is firmly back in
It's all going to be set, unless there's some mileage in this legal challenge, then we will start having an election campaign through the summer. It'll be settled before Labour Party conference in the autumn. And in actual fact, from as John McDonnell said, if the Labour Party is in the news all the way through the summer, even if we're knocking 9 bells out of each other, that means that we're actually dominating the news cycle and arguing about austerity, for example.
I would imagine it's going to be more like backbiting. But look, let's not forget about UKIP, because they've had an interesting decision this week. Their only MP, Douglas Carswell, has been blocked from running for the party's leader. You just have to laugh, don't you? He's not going to be allowed. Well, they've changed the rules to say that only people who've been members of their party for, I think it's 5 years or something, are allowed to stand to be leader. And so that he cannot, even though he's their only MP. Also, there are some others that have been blocked. What do you make of UKIP? Are they a spent force now we've got this Brexit vote, Jeff?
I think he's very lucky. It spares him from having to put himself through all that. One really does wonder at any organisation where the executive committee changes the rules as they go along. And I'm not making a political point against the Labour Party, because that was actually a case where they were interpreting the rules as they went along, which is very different. But it does seem very odd that UKIP is changing rules. And they're an organisation, in a sense, without a cause now. Because they've succeeded in getting a majority to vote for what they want. And they don't actually know how to deliver it or what to deliver, because they don't have policies that apply to life either in a city or within a region or national economic policies that will work, and therefore
if someone was here from UKIP they would say, well, we do have policies, and when we were campaigning in the general election, and particularly someone like Douglas Carswell, I mean, he seems a very articulate guy. Actually, heard him a few times talking about, we are trying to break the political cabal, and I think there's many people who would say similar things. He's talking about politics as a kind of cartel, you know, where actually only people who agree with what the city wants and the establishment wants will get anywhere close to power. And there are some people now in Britain who are trying to break that. But anyway, look, before we go on, let's have a listen to the final Prime Minister's questions with Jeremy Corbyn and David Cameron, where Jeremy decided to talk about and ask David Cameron about starter housings of £450,000, starter homes.
Mr. Speaker, I've been listening carefully to what the Home Secretary's been saying over the last few days, and she said it's harder than ever for young people to buy their first house. So does the Prime Minister think this is because of record low house building, or his government's apparent belief that £450,000 is an affordable starter home?
Well, first of all, let me say at the dispatch box how warmly I congratulate the Home Secretary on becoming leader of the Conservative Party. When it comes to women prime ministers, I'm very pleased to be able to say pretty soon it's going to be 2-0. And not a pink bus in sight, Mr. Speaker. On the issue of housing and homelessness, as I said, 700,000 homes have been delivered. He asks about this issue of affordability, which is absolutely key. When I became Prime Minister, because of what had happened to the mortgage market, a first-time buyer often needed to have as much as £30,000 to put a deposit down. Because of the combination of Help to Buy and shared ownership, some people are actually able to get on the housing ladder now with a deposit of as little as £2,000, and with the low mortgage rates as well, and the new houses we're building, we're making good progress.
Well, making good progress, but £450,000 is a lot of money for a starter home, Jeff.
It is. It is. We need affordable houses that people can actually afford to buy. And yeah, I don't know about the situation in London, where I realise house prices are very different, but down here, undoubtedly, we need more houses.
I mean, if the places that have been built on Finsmore's Reach at the moment, in the city centre here, if they halved them, they still might not sell them all, because they're building places that aren't actually selling, aren't they?
they are, and they're not building the volume houses that are needed to provide cheap, affordable housing for those who need one- and two-bedroom accommodation in the centre of the city where it is close to the work that they that is available to them. And that is where the council has to play its part in proactively helping to generate sufficient new housing to ease the housing crisis in Bristol.
Martin, £450,000 for a starter home, it's just not going to work, is it?
Well, we shouldn't be obsessed with home ownership. We should be obsessed with getting decent homes for people, possibly some rented homes. And I welcome the fact that the Conservative Party have joined the Labour administration in Bristol, because in Bristol, we do things differently. We take this seriously, and we're going to try and do something together to resolve these problems. And incidentally, of course, that shows the right wing of the Labour Party that we're not the ideologues that they sometimes think that we are.
Or what was it? The sort of cult-like figure, I think Kerry called Jeremy Corbyn. Anyway, another question at Prime Minister's Questions was about, the big question, of course, is Scotland, Trident, and the possible exit of Scotland from the United Kingdom.
Carol Monaghan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Between broken vows, Brexit, and the likely renewal of weapons of mass destruction in the Clyde. The Prime Minister has done more for Scottish independence than many of us on these benches could ever hope to do. So, as he contemplates a move to Aberdeenshire, could the Prime Minister now make his commitment to Scottish independence official by visiting smp.org/join?
What I'd say to the Honourable Lady, and indeed to all the SNP Members of Parliament, is when you have Lord Smith himself saying that the vow to create a powerhouse Parliament was kept, the SNP should pay attention to that and recognise a promise was made and a promise was delivered. I've talked many times at this dispatch box about creating this powerhouse Parliament. What I haven't seen is the SNP using any of the powers they've now got.
Well, I mean, this is, it's political theatre, isn't it?
But it's not. It's actually quite... I mean, there is such a degree of that, but these are two massive issues, aren't they? Trident, which is coming along very soon, and the possible exit of Scotland.
Well, yes, I mean, they are big issues. I mean, the Trident issue, Theresa May has demonstrated kind of political nous, if you like, by bringing the Trident vote forward, because she knows it will create divisions in the Labour Party, which it will. And, of course... in Scotland, they do not want Trident. They've made that absolutely clear. And if they get independence, they will close Faslane. The Americans want to know about that. Of course they do, and so on. I mean, to be honest, I think there's no case, really, for Britain to have independent nuclear weapons. They're massively expensive. We're never going to use them. They are history. How do the independent nuclear deterrent prevent the outrage in Nice yesterday? It didn't do anything to prevent it. And, in fact, it's pointless.
Jeff?
Well, I believe an independent nuclear deterrent has been essential to maintaining peace and maintaining our position in the world. I believe, however, we do need to be assessing whether we are still in a position to use that deterrent and to use conventional means to protect our position.
Okay, that's Jeff Gollop, Conservative councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henbury.
Henlees.
Thanks, Jeff, for correcting me. We're back after the news talking about Nice and the Spratly Islands.
Radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.